This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Shao-Ik. It's our public health series today with my co-host, Azrul Mohammad Khalib, CEO of the Galen Centre for Health and Social Policy. How are you, Azrul? Selamat Hari Raya.
Thank you very much, Shao-Ik. It's been a very, very tiring Hari Raya with lots of unhealthy food, I think. And we're talking about, of all things today, diabetes.
We always say there's no such thing as good or bad food. It's the habits that are unhealthy, perhaps.
But they also say moderation, right? Yeah. Nobody eats in moderation.
Nobody understands what moderation means. But, you know, Malaysians, we love our festive eating. We also love our bargains, don't we? When you can get two for the price of one, that kind of thing. But here's something that you kind of won't want things to be bundled together. And that's if you have diabetes, you have a higher risk of cardiorenal metabolic diseases like chronic kidney disease, cardiovascular disease, stroke, all developing together. Your risk increases, dramatically. And considering the very high prevalence of diabetes in Malaysia, this compounds the burden of the cardiorenal metabolic diseases. Now, how exactly are these diseases linked? Why do they all tend to cluster together, and how do we disrupt it? Joining us in conversation today are Dr. Faisal Mustafa, Director of the Para State Health Department, and Professor Dr. Rohana Abdul Ghani, Consultant Endocrinologist from University Technology Mara, and also President of the Malaysian Obesity Society. Dr. Faisal and Prof. Rohana, thank you as well for joining us. How are the both of you today?
Hi, Shari.
And hello to you both.
And Selamat Hari Raya to both of you as well. And to our listeners, do call us with your questions or thoughts that you'd like to share. Diabetes is something that we all either have somebody in our family who has it, you know somebody who has been diagnosed with it, and of course, that cluster of other diseases we've been talking about. Your questions or your thoughts, 03-7733-2900 is the number to call, or WhatsApp us at our U mobile number 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. Dr. Faisal, can we get you to start with scaring our listeners a little bit? Perhaps you could share either the top three or the top most alarming facts about diabetes in Malaysia today.
All right. So I'll stick to three. Firstly, we should be worried that we have a high prevalence of diabetes in Malaysia. Prevalence means the number of Malaysians living with diabetes. The latest survey that has been published in 2019 shows that almost one in six Malaysian adults have high blood sugar, and we do expect this to go up. We are still waiting for the latest survey in 2023 to be published. However, I can tell you already, it is going up. So that's first thing we should be worried about. More and more Malaysians have diabetes. Secondly, another pattern we have been seeing over the years, the younger age group are more likely to get diabetes as well. So they are getting younger and younger, and the number of younger Malaysians getting diabetes has also gone up. So first, overall numbers going up. Second, they're getting younger. And third, I think, which is more relevant in the bigger picture, we need to look at the economic and burden to the health system. Because, economic is one of the key, the top topics being discussed right now. As more and more Malaysians becomes suffers from diabetes, it's not just about the cost of treating people living with diabetes, but people living with diabetes are less economically productive. And the country have to support them more, not just from the health aspect, but from the social welfare aspect as well. So you have costs being driven up that has to be borne by the country, and you have a less economically productive population. So I'll stop there at 3 points.
Prof. Rohana, is there anything that you'd like to add to those three already alarming enough?
In addition to that, Shari, what I also find most alarming is the fact that half of the patients, half of that number that Faisal was saying, half of them are actually undiagnosed, meaning they're not even aware that they have the disease. And you're talking about the diabetes within the diabetes range itself, right? And that is half of the population of that disease state. And as well as that, also there's a proportion who are in the pre-diabetes state, which means that they're not really within the range of diabetes, but they have abnormally high, either in the fasting state or after meal sugar levels. And as well as that, what is also alarming to us clinicians as endocrinologists, as well as our primary care physicians, is that most of the patients now with diabetes who are currently on treatment, and this is irrespective of whether they are in the primary care or secondary or tertiary care, they have very poor sugar control. Only approximately between 20-30% of our patients have achieved our target HbA1c of 6.5-7%. So again, these are a really worrying figures, I would say, to start off with.
To start off with, that's already so much to think about. You say that half of those one in six adults are actually undiagnosed. Tell us, Prof, how stealthily diabetes develops in a person, and it could be something that you're living with long before you are diagnosed with it.
Right. Okay. The problem with diabetes is that it's completely asymptomatic. Patients feel well. They have no problems. It's not, it's unlike having chest pain when they're having a heart attack, for example. So patients don't even notice that the sugar level is high. And the symptoms that we commonly describe, that they have increased thirst, they have increased passing out urine, that doesn't happen in most patients. However, what is more important is that from early studies in basic science studies has been shown that the abnormality in the sugar responses in patients happen about approximately 5 years before the diagnosis. And upon the diagnosis itself, half of the islet cells are considered abnormal already. So this, it is a progressive disease. It gets worse with age, it gets worse with time. And so, in addition, those patients who I mentioned before, where pre-diabetes, i.e. the sugar levels are high but not within diabetic range, they already have been clinically proven that have substantially increased cardiovascular risk, meaning they have increased risk of getting heart disease and stroke. So all these facts may not be available to patients and they may have very little understanding of it, but this is the nature of the disease.
Dr. Faisal, from your perspective, and you said that even when before the 2023 data comes out, you can already predict that those statistics are going to increase. Why? Why is our prevalence increasing? Why is it so the way it is now, especially when we compare Malaysia to other countries in the region?
All right. For several reasons. So firstly, looking at the dietary habits. So we were just talking about the Hari Raya meals, right? So every day seems to be a cheat day. So that's one. So it's not just about the dietary habits. Genetic susceptibility. We do know that the Indian ethnicity and even the Malay ethnicity have higher risk of developing diabetes. Thirdly, I would say the urbanization. The rapid urbanization, sorry. So it's not just urbanization, the rapid urbanization that we are seeing. And with the rapid urbanization, it's not just of economic development. You also see this concurrent issue about poverty or relative poverty, the urban poor. We do know already from studies that economic disparity also will contribute to poor health outcomes. That includes diabetes as well. Look at the risk factors. One of the major risk factors driving diabetes is your overweight, being overweight and obesity. And that continues to increase in Malaysia. And lastly, the other risk factors we look at, we talk about long term, is childhood stunting and childhood obesity. Our study shows that we do have, sorry, I don't have the figures offhand, the number of childhood obesity continues to go up. And childhood stunting also continues to go up, unfortunately. And both being stunted children and overweight children will become overweight and obese adults. And that increases their risk for NCDs and talking about diabetes today. So these are some of the factors that will drive the diabetes epidemic, as it were.
Azrul?
You know, Shawit, going back to the data that was presented earlier, and also what we know about diabetes. Diabetes is not a new disease. It's not something that's unfamiliar. And we consider the fact that today, the National Health Mobility Survey that was conducted by the Ministry of Health a couple of years ago, and Dr. Faisal mentioned 2019, indicated very clearly that 3.9 million people are currently living with diabetes, estimated, both diagnosed and undiagnosed. And what is startling is that the same study, as well as others, projected that by next year, 2025, that number will be adding on another 7 to 8 million. And this is where, when you look at all the policies that have already come into place, what we know about the disease, how our behavior, our habits and so forth, it's only so much that you can have policies do, but it goes back to the community themselves, society itself. And a lot of the times when we look at diabetes in Malaysia, it's almost as if we have failed when it comes to addressing diabetes properly. And perhaps I wanted to get Prof. Rohana's take on this. If you were to look at Malaysia and other countries around this region, and Malaysia is among the highest, not only in Asia, but actually in the world when it comes to diabetes. Prof. Rohana, how do we rate against these other countries?
Thank you, Azrul. I completely agree with you that we stand very high in the list. However, we're not really the top countries. But in terms of obesity, we are indeed have been the fattest nation in the region. So that has, if I can just underscore that, the importance of linking diabetes and obesity, as Faisal has alluded to, that most of our diabetics in Malaysia now are actually obese. 80% of our patients are obese. Very few are those who are actually lean diabetics. So understanding that for a fact will basically tell you that it is a metabolic disorder. It is a progressive disease. It is asymptomatic. And so therefore, that is a real struggle for us to convince patients that, there's something wrong with you and you should stop eating. That's for one, right? And understand that the complications associated with diabetes. Sorry, yes, Ezra.
Oh, no. But Prof. Rana, I think when you look at the complications, and it was indicated earlier in Shaoyi's introduction, it's also not just about diabetes, right? It's all linked together with something we call the cardiorenal metabolic disease, right? It's a combination of diseases. So how does this all link together as a framework?
As a syndrome, right?
Yeah,
it is. Well, it starts with what you understand. I'm sure you've heard of metabolic syndrome. So again, I suppose emphasizing that it's a metabolic abnormalities. And hyperglycemia is an inflammatory condition that it affects the whole system, the whole body. And they are linked because they are within the same kind of environment, right? So however, diabetes itself is probably the fundamental of all this inflammation going on, because that is what we call glucotoxicity. It is toxic to the body. And so therefore, how we are set apart is probably because we are phenotypically different. Asians are generally known to have an increased cardiovascular risk at a lower BMI compared to our Caucasian counterparts. And as well as that, certain ethnicity, I think Faisal mentioned that, for example, Indians, they carry, it's a genetic susceptibility that not only are they more prone to this hyperglycemia and diabetes, they are at a much higher risk in terms of heart diseases and kidney diseases, for example, so compared to the Chinese race, for example. So all these things, because we are probably the most diverse population compared to our neighboring countries. So again, there is still a lot of work to understand all this. But I would just like to add on to the other risk factors that Faisal has mentioned. We have modifiable risk factors and we have non-modifiable risk factors. So genetic susceptibility is a non-modifiable risk factor. But we also forget about the other important ones, including, for example, gestational diabetes, whereby women are found to be diabetic in pregnancy. But you'd be surprised that our policy at the moment has a very low detection rate and follow-up for these patients. And this is a kind of a worrying situation because, you know, it's almost 90% of those patients with GDM will develop diabetes in the future. It's a matter of when. Mm. And for example, pre-diabetes, we are currently in a group that's working very hard on, you know, creating awareness in pre-diabetes among our population. Again, trying to tell everybody that if you do not do anything, you will get diabetes. It's a matter of time. But if you take control and you do something about it, and you know, you can change the course of the course of the disease, and of course family history as well. So that's among others. Yeah,
it all unfortunately does come back to the fact that it's so silent. It doesn't cause you any pain, discomfort. You don't feel any burden of the disease, and therefore, you're not actually motivated to change anything. But we'll go for a quick break and come back to continue this discussion about diabetes and how it links to cardiorenal metabolic diseases like chronic kidney disease, cardiovascular disease, stroke, all linked with obesity as well. You can call us with your thoughts. Why do you think Malaysians are struggling with this problem? 03-7733-2900. WhatsApp us at our U mobile number 01878 988 89, or tweet us at BFM Radio. We'll be right back on Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
Bringing fresh meaning, BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Shaoik, and my co-host for the Public Health series today, Azrul Mohamad Khalid from the Galen Centre for Health and Social Policy. We're speaking to Dr. Faisal Mustafa, Director of the Perak State Health Department, and Professor Dr. Rohana Abdul Ghani, the President of the Malaysian Obesity Society. We're discussing diabetes, how it compounds the risk of cardiorenal metabolic diseases, why this is such a serious burden in Malaysia, and what can we do at an individual as well as at a systemic level to change the trajectory of these diseases. Call us with your thoughts. Why do you think that even after years of, you know, so many education and awareness campaigns, healthcare professionals recognizing the severity of this problem, why are we still struggling to manage it? 03-7733-2900 is the number to call, or 01878 88 89 is the number to WhatsApp. We have Kevin who wants to share. There's too much sugar in the Malaysian diet, not enough meat, too much carbs. It's just unreal how much sugar there is in our drinks. Dr. Faisal, is that something you want to put into perspective, what Kevin has shared in terms of, and you talked about risk factors earlier. What is it about the diet that we need to address?
All right, I think Azrul earlier said something about failure. So, you know, what have we failed? I think from the healthcare system perspective, we have done a lot, but it is already providing treatment for people already living with the condition. It's not really focusing on prevention, both for the diabetes itself and complications. Going back to the question about diet, it is a question about, is it a choice or you don't have a choice? And I think we need to understand that for some population in Malaysia, choices are hard to come by. When you are struggling, for example, to put food on the table, the quality of your food becomes secondary, right? Not really answering the question. The study done in the UK, not looking at diabetes, looking at health outcomes, it is interesting that it is your postcode where you live actually determines whether you have a good health outcome or bad health outcome. So what I'm trying to go back now is to look at what are the determinants of health. So one determinant of health, which I've mentioned, is poverty. So yes, maybe certain segment of the population are very aware, have high literacy. Literacy is not just about knowledge, right? Literacy is about how you consume that knowledge and how does it translate into your behavior. So some population have high literacy, but we do know a lot of population have low literacy, even in Malaysia. And unfortunately, it is the most susceptible population, the most at-risk population, who has the highest level of low health literacy. Whereas those people, you know, listening to BFM, I'm assuming you're very motivated, you got high literacy, financial literacy, ample health literacy. My assumption, you know, I don't have any data to back that up. So you are the converted people who know the healthier food. But regardless, the diet is unhealthy, correct? We do live in an obesogenic environment in Malaysia. But knowledge, you know, you do have choices, but maybe for some people it's not an easy choice to choose from talking about dietary. So I'm just going to stick to diet now, not even talk about physical activity, you know, and that's another, and the other risk factors like smoking. So that's other risk factors that contribute to poor health outcomes.
You know, it's definitely something that we can all agree with, that in Malaysia, it's not that simple. You mentioned just now stunting, Dr. Faisal, and, you know, the data from NHMS, the Ministry of Health survey, again, indicated that when you look at stunting in the country, it's, what, 1 in 5 of all children and a third of kids below the age of 4, I think, who are currently suffering from stunted growth. And this is something that's quite worrying, because at one end, we are talking about overeating or having too much of food. But at the other end, we find that there's stunting happening, which is actually as a cause of malnutrition, which is insufficient nutrition. And this goes back to not just about an issue of food choices, but also what Dr. Faisal mentioned just now about the economic factors, where, you know, you find that people with lower income, you know, they tend to go for cheaper and less nutritious food due to their limited financial resources. And so it's very hard to sometimes see what works and what does not. Health minister, the former health minister, Dr. Zaliha, actually introduced a very important initiative last year to try to address this problem of diabetes in Putrajaya, yeah? Just Putrajaya alone. And the idea was to get shop retail outlets and so forth to reduce the amount of sugar that was being included into beverages and food and so forth. But you know what, Shawit? It didn't work, because people were demanding, it's not sweet enough, can you increase back the sugar, you know? And so it works against, even when you have a system that is trying to encourage people to be healthier, we ourselves are actually putting ourselves into a state of unhealthiness. And this is where we have this torrent of diseases, you know, where you see a chronic kidney disease, renal failure is on uptick, cardiovascular disease. There are so many people who are having stroke. And in fact, a member of parliament, if you not too long ago, actually suffered a stroke episode in the Dewan Rakyat, you know, just a few years ago. So it touches every part of society.
And on that point, we have a listener who said, we have also normalized diabetes, so much so that everyone just goes, oh, diabetes, that's okay. Or tinggi gula. And Prof. Rohana, how do you deal with that attitude? I'm sure you come across it, maybe not all. I'm sure you come across it in some of your patients. How do you get through to them that it's not okay to just let it be? And also perhaps to widen that perspective to look at how our healthcare system could make that shift that Dr. Faisal said. We do very well with treatment now. That's where you are, Prof. Rohana, at that end of the spectrum. But how do we take that burden off the clinicians and do more on the prevention side of things?
Okay, thank you, Sherry. I think I need to bring my tone slightly, bring it down a bit, because I get excited when I talk about this, right? So anyway, so I think to start off with, I would just like to echo Kevin, right? But how many of patients actually are able to say that there's just too much sugar? How many? Not many, because as Azra said, they'll just say it's not enough, it's not sweet enough, you know? And actually someone actually said to me that the sugar tax didn't work. But my question was, why? Why didn't it work? And although I would like to, from our point of view, from a medical point of view, we always say that diabetes is a complex disease because it's not as simple as, you know, refraining from taking sugar because you have all these other factors that we have mentioned previously. However, why can't we simplify it, Azrul? Why can't we just say, don't eat too much, just don't take too much sugar? You know, you talk in the beginning is about moderation, but just stop at too much, you know? And you know, so that question really revolves around not even going to treatment yet. It's about the early part, because I always tell patients this, right? First and foremost, whatever sugar there is, your sugar level comes from where? It doesn't come from the air, of course. It comes from the things that you put in your mouth. So if you don't want too much treatment, don't put too much sugar in your body. And sugar comes in many forms. Either it's a simple sugar, the table sugar that is, or it comes with all those types of carbohydrate. So, you know, it's just a matter of choosing. So therefore, if you say, and Faisal says this, that people, our population are too busy putting food on the table. But I have a lot of patients who will tell me they miss appointments. They didn't come and take medications because I don't have time to go and take medication. And then the sugar levels remain high. And then they come in with kidney problems, with heart diseases. And I say to them, if you come in for heart disease and you can't work for a whole 3 weeks or so, then who's going to earn for you? And if you are so busy earning money now, and as harsh as it sounds, I say this to my patients, you are so busy earning money now for what? Is it to prepare for your renal replacement therapy and your dialysis treatment later? You know, as harsh as it sounds, you know, really, because their creatinine and their kidney function is deteriorating because they're just too busy to take care of themselves. So, you know, I wish it can be a much simpler way of saying it, but I have to stop at sugar, from sugarcoating it, you know.
Sugarcoating it, that's right.
Yeah, because diabetes is not about the disease itself. It's about the complications.
Mm. Dr. Faisal, we have Lau who messaged in to say, how about something like continuous glucose monitoring to identify people who are pre-diabetic? I wanted to use that to get your thoughts on where can we do better with that screening, the early detection, and the prevention part of things. I still feel that there's a huge gap there. What are your thoughts on that?
Right. Let's talk about the early detection, the screening. That means you already have high blood sugar and you don't know. And Prof. Rohana did mention that NHMS shows that almost 1 in 2 people with high blood sugar do not know they have high blood sugar because they do not undergo health screening. And the other component for the NHMS also looks at the last time you had a health screening. And by this definition, it's just basic health screening, you know, your blood pressure, blood sugar, cholesterol, your BMI. So 1 in 2 do not do. There are some research that have been done, even in Malaysia and in the neighboring countries, looking at why people are not actually coming up. So one of the major barriers for them is ignorance is bliss. They rather not know. And this one interesting statement really catches my attention. And it just, for them, I don't have a disease. Doing screening means I look for disease. So why do I want to cari penyakit? Why do I want to look for a disease?
Yeah.
So I do not have the answer to address this. It's not lack of knowledge. It is not lack of awareness. It's just this belief that I do not want disease. All right? So I would need help from people who are, you know, experts in behavior. I'm a hard science person, being a doctor, not the soft science, you know, called anthropologist behavior. No, seriously, we do need people to understand behaviors better, because just doing our messaging of trying to raise awareness and knowledge will not work. We have done it for so many years, right? That's the one thing. Second thing about glucose monitoring. This is one interesting, is maybe relevant here, maybe not. I do have, anecdotally, of course, it's not supported by data. People do not want to monitor because they do not want to know and they don't want to be nagged. So again, this part of ignorance. It's interesting now technology allows you to be monitored remotely. If you have one of those devices, even your nurse will be in the UK, for example, can look, oh, there's a spike in blood sugar, and can call you up and saying, what's happening here, Azrul? Why is your blood sugar going yeah, and then I would say, so I just had a durian meal kind of thing. So do you really want to know that someone's monitoring, your big brother is watching you? I do know for a fact a lot of Malaysians do not want to be neck men, especially. Yeah, and so that's the other aspect of behavior. So just to summarize, there are tools out there that can help us manage, screen, manage better, but we do not understand why Malaysians do not. How to convince Malaysians to engage with this, especially those who do not want to change their behavior. Those who want to change their behavior, that's fine. There are plenty of people. Those are the kind of, see, Prof. Rohana, they want to change their life, or maybe she will defer. But yeah, so how do we target people who don't want to change their behavior? That will be the challenge for us. I don't have the answer for that.
Prof, you'd like to add?
Yes, I don't have the answer to that either, Faisal. I just want to make a comment about, I think the new device now is the Libre they're talking about, the glucose monitoring system that allows you to just wear a device and then it will measure it through the skin. It's kind of interesting and exciting, I suppose, device. However, that would not be very useful for pre-diabetic patients. Pre-diabetes patients need to have their blood sugars taken, and that's in the fasting state as well as the 2 hours post-meal. And I would actually encourage those people who have risk factors, including family history of diabetes, gestation diabetes, that is diabetes in pregnancy, those who are obese and overweight, and perhaps those who have been told to have slightly high sugars when they go for medical checkup. So that's the main thing. And bearing in mind that this condition is progressive, it will develop diabetes in due time and it can be prevented. So I think that's just that one to comment on.
At this point, I just wanted to mention, because for a lot of people, they think that diabetes is just diabetes. But actually, as what was mentioned earlier, it's actually a gateway, really, towards other conditions as well. And when you look at the data for chronic kidney disease, we find that in Malaysia, you find that diabetics are 3.5 times more likely to develop chronic kidney disease. And you find that around, what, more than 5 million or 15.6% of the Malaysian population is actually living with chronic kidney disease. So, you know, there is a situation here that's developing where diabetes is exacerbating a lot of other conditions which are existing together. So concurrently, you're having not just diabetes, you're also having cardiovascular disease, you're having renal disease as well. And this is something that we need to really look at, especially when we look at the expenditures. Right? If you look at the amount of money that we've spent or invested in this, you find that diabetes actually is the highest compared to all the other diseases. I think it's around 4 billion based on a Ministry of Health WHO survey not too long ago, which is far higher than cancer, which I think is three times as more than cancer. So the issue here is that Malaysia today subsidizes insulin for those who are diabetic, right? And this is something that we're very fortunate. In other countries, people are fighting to get insulin prices down, and I think we sometimes take it for granted that this is something that the Malaysian government provides at no cost to the patient, but at tremendous cost to the government. And that bill is going up by the hundreds of millions every year. And this is something that we need to be able to address. Prevention is important, not just to treat those who are already diabetic, and this is type 2 diabetics, but also, prevent new cases from arising. And I wanted to get Prof. Rohana's opinion on that, because it seems like we are unable to prevent new cases and the bill keeps going up.
Prof?
Yes. Azra, I just want to pick up on that currently that Malaysia has the highest number of patients on dialysis secondary to diabetes, that is diabetic nephropathy,
exactly.
And in the world, that is. So Malaysia has been for at least three years. And how do I know this? Because my husband is a nephrologist. But anyway, so I know it would be valid.
The referral pathway is very close.
Very quick.
yeah. So in terms of, I think you were quoting the 2017 figure that was quoted by the ministers at the time, which is 4 billion ringgit, right? Which is half of the total expenditure in health health services are much higher than cancer. It's interesting that you mentioned that, because that is what I say to my patients. Diabetes is very similar to cancer because it's a progressive disease that eats up all these little, little cells in your body that causes all these complications. So you can't run away with it. So I asked them, do you think that you will be spared from kidney disease? You will not. You know, so things like this. And the scare tactic, I suppose. You talk about insulin therapy. Insulin therapy is subsidized in Malaysia with a human insulin. The analogs, not so much, because they're expensive. They have their own role in terms of treatment of insulin. However, insulin is not the treatment, and not the solution to good glycemic control. It has its own side effects, but it is useful for achieving glycemic target. We use it, we use it a lot. But at the same time, you know, patients also have the side effects of weight gain and hypoglycemia. So it has to be done in a controlled manner that is used appropriately and effectively.
We'll go for another very quick break to and we'll come back to continue the conversation. My co-host Azrul Muhammad Khalib, along with Dr. Faisal Mustafa, Professor Dr. Rohana Abdul Ghani, we're discussing diabetes and its burden on the population and on our healthcare system. Do call us with your thoughts. Why do you think we're still grappling with bringing diabetes under control? 03-7733-2900 or WhatsApp 018-789-8899. We'll be right back on Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
Building fit Malaysians, BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Shao Ik, and my co-host for the public health segment, Azrul Muhammad Khalib from the Galen Center for Health and Social Policy. We're speaking today to Professor Dr. Rohana Abdul Ghani, a consultant endocrinologist and also president of the Malaysian Obesity Society, and Dr. Faisal Mustafa, director of the Perak State Health Department, about managing the burden of diabetes in Malaysia. Why is it such a huge problem for our population, costing Azrul, before the break, you mentioned that it's costing the government billions of ringgit. It's us who's paying that bill from our taxpayers' money. Share your thoughts with us, 03-7733-2900. If you have thoughts about how we can improve things, you can also WhatsApp 018-789-8899. We talked a lot about the gap that lies now in getting behavioral change to happen at the individual level. I was wondering if we could adopt something like what the NHS in UK is doing, where they have something called social prescribing. Healthcare providers refer patients to link workers who are like social workers, who then find out more about the socioeconomic determinants of patients and underlying their health problems. And these link workers can then connect people to activities, groups or services in their community in order to address those socioeconomic determinants, similar to what you mentioned, Dr. Faisal. What are your thoughts? I know we don't want to copy models from other countries, but what kind of approach can we look at beyond clinical treatment that could address those wider factors, Dr. Faisal?
Right. Thank you. Firstly, thank you very much for introducing social prescribing. I think a lot of Malaysians would not recognize that word even. Even if there are certain aspects of social prescribing we are doing, especially for people living with cancers, for example. Mm-hmm. I think that's the most established in Malaysia. Yeah. Several years ago, when I was still working in Putrajaya, I did try to explore social prescribing, especially from the research perspective, the feasibility of implementing it in Malaysia, but that did not really take off. I think that, yes, it is something that we could explore, certainly. Certainly, it will be a different way of doing things, and I'm all for trying to explore different ways of doing things in Malaysia, because you can't be doing the same thing expecting different results. However, I could see several challenges here. Social prescribing hinges on the fact that there are services available outside for us healthcare workers to prescribe and to refer. So when it comes to diabetes specifically, it is limited. Even for people living with cancer, it is limited even in more in the urban areas. So you are talking about reach. you need to think about the appropriateness and acceptability of our population as well, the demand side. We are talking about supply, but we need to look at the demand side, especially referring back to my talk about the screening we can offer, but we're not sure whether people would want the demand side. The integration with healthcare is another aspect that we need to look into, but that's, for me, minor. That can easily be done. But ensuring that all individuals in Malaysia who should be getting social prescribing have access to it throughout the country, equity, that will be something of a challenge. Awareness and education will be on both healthcare workers and also for the population to increase demand. So yeah, I'm all for exploring it further. I do not know anyone doing work, real work, in Malaysia besides doing research on it. Yeah, I would be interested to explore that further.
And you're right, Dr. Faisal. This is a very new term for Malaysians. I want to plug a podcast that we did on health and living where we spoke to somebody from the UK doing social prescribing. So do check that out if you want to find out more. But Azrul, you had a question.
Yeah, I mean, speaking about prescribing, there's also some opportunities that have arisen over the past couple of years with pharmaceutical interventions. And I'm curious to know what Prof. Rohana, since you deal with the treatment of people living with diabetes, is it possible for us to provide interventions before they need to be on insulin? And I'm referring to the availability now of SGLT2 inhibitors. I think it's sodium glucose co-transporter 2 inhibitors, which actually lowers the blood sugar level by basically preventing the reabsorption of sugar by the kidneys into the bloodstream. So, you know, it's a form of managing, I think, type 2 diabetes. Is it possible for us to manage the caseload today by perhaps, you know, having more people being on these sort of inhibitors as a way of intervention? Because it seems like behavioral change is really, really tough. It's really getting to a point where, you know, people have just given up on it, and we may have to resort to more, you know, pharmaceutical interventions that could actually prevent a bigger disaster in the future, though it may cost us a lot in the short term. What do you think, Prof?
Yes, thank you, Andrew. I think what I want to emphasize on is the fact that the fundamental treatment should really go diet lifestyle first, okay? So let me just get that out of the way. However, within a couple of decades recently, we have had an explosion of pharmacotherapy and armamentarium in diabetes. That we always say this because we used to only be dealing with metformin, sulfonylurea, carbos, and then we have insulin. But now we have a lot of other options. We understand that the underlying pathophysiology of diabetes is complex. We can target many organs now. Okay, so the two main pharmacotherapy there is most talked about in recent times, the SGLT2 inhibitors, which is an oral form, and the GLP-1 receptor agonist, which is an injectable form currently, but we also have received the oral form now. So these two have been shown to improve HbA1c, improve glucose level, sugar level, associated with weight loss, as well as other kidney and heart protection. So the treatment of diabetes have moved away from just targeting glucose level, but it has also now targeting at what we call kidney protection and heart protection with these two agents. Yes, absolutely. However, these treatments come at a cost. So SGLT2 has been able to reduce the price because of, it has been in the market for quite some time, but GLP-1 has remained quite expensive and it is not accessible to most patients. Okay, so that's why we want to talk about the treatment of diabetes is currently adding an additional burden to not only the ministry but also, you know, insurance, as well as, you know, companies, industry, etc. But however, these are options for patients. Yes, absolutely.
I want to read out a few messages related to sugar, and these are suggestions from our listeners when it comes to policies around sugar consumption. Perhaps food stalls should charge more for sugar. We should stop sugar subsidies. We should enforce beverage and food manufacturers to maintain low levels of sugar in the products, and advertising, you know, banning advertising of sugary food and drinks on media, just like we did with cigarette advertising, and, you know, include, so you have pictures of the health conditions on cigarette packs. You could do the same with pictures of amputated legs on, you know, high sugar products. A variety of thoughts there just related to sugar control. Dr. Faisal, would you want to very, very quickly weigh in on that?
I think that takes a very simplistic view of what's causing diabetes. But then again, how do I make it simple? making it complex. Experts have a way of making things, simple things appear complex. Diet is just one aspect. Don't forget, we already develop our dietary habits even from young. I suppose my message is here for young parents or for young adults. Please make sure that when you do have kids, please expose your kids to the right dietary habits, as it were, so that you can reduce their risk of diabetes as they grow older. And secondly, everything in moderation. Even a good food, as it were, if taken in excess, can be bad for your health. So I would say that when it comes to policy, regulatory intervention, like sugar tax, is this just forms part of the intervention? It is not the only solution. A lot of things need to be in place for us to see a real impact. However, we need to start somewhere. And the implementation of sugar tax in many countries have shown a reduction in the purchasing pattern if the quantum is high enough. One. And secondly, if you really understand what are the sources of excess calorie being taken among the population. So in Malaysia, we do have too many sources of excess calorie, and the sugar tax will only address a specific part of it, but not stopping it. It will be the same concept for tobacco control. There are many things that need to be done, and some, you know, you may argue one or the other not effective on its own. So yeah, I'll stop there.
We can't tax everything, right?
Well, I don't think the government should have full responsibility to regulate your behavior. That sounds like too communist to me.
No, that's a very good point. How much, to what extent should you be policing behaviors? But it comes back to that very, very difficult question of getting behavioral change. Unfortunately, I do have to wrap up this discussion. Plenty of food for thought. What can we do today just to stop that demand curtail the excesses where we can. Our guests, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts today. Dr. Faisal Mustafa, Director of the Perak State Health Department, Professor Dr. Rohana Abdul Ghani, President of the Malaysian Obesity Society, and my co-host Azrul Mohamad Khalid from the Galen Centre for Health and Social Policy. You've been listening to Health and Living on BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.